WSHU's Join the Conversation series is sponsored by IKEA New Haven, the Wyand Cimbeli Group, and Bridgeport Hospital.
I'm now delighted to introduce WSHU's award-winning news director, Naomi Starobin, and one of America's most respected broadcast journalists and local resident, Jane Pauley.
Thank you, Gillian.
Thank you, Gillian.
Thank you, everybody.
Good evening, good evening. Welcome to everybody, and thank you for coming. It looks like a very full house, which is terrific, and welcome to Jane Pauley. You know, it's so terrific to see somebody you think you know well, because she's been on television talking to you on a daily basis, and then there she is in front of you. And some of you I spoke with before the show said, I feel like I know her.
Yes. Well, you do.
Yeah, you do.
We see each other at the Super Stop and Shop at exit 56.
Yeah. Well, now you've just increased their business considerably.
Yeah.
Well, a little quick bio, not that anybody doesn't know who Jane Pauley is, but let's all just get caught up. Jane Pauley was the co-host of Today from 1976 to 1989, anchored Dateline NBC for 11 years, hosted The Jane Pauley Show, and has won, of course, many awards for her contributions to journalism and your activism in many causes, some related to mental illness. She has also written a memoir called Skywriting, A Life Out of the Blue. That was in 2004 that was published and was on New York Times bestseller list for a while.
Thank you for mentioning that.
You can't hear.
She said that my memoir was on the New York Times bestseller list.
I guess the volume can be taken care of, right? How's
we'll
that?
Yeah.
That's better?
We'll talk up and...
No, not
no.
better.
Yeah.
Louder.
We need some.
I don't
want
to yell. Okay. How's that? Is that any better? No. There's much unhappiness in that.
Maybe if we just sat at the end of the stage and you all... Is there anything we can do about those?
Let's use our outside voices.
Okay. I mean, you've got to project to the people in the back. See, I hear myself coming and going. I sound like I'm talking too loud, but you don't think so?
No, not too loud. And how's this?
I'll tell Gary that you said that I wasn't talking too loud this time.
I'm not even finished with the biography yet.
Oh, yeah, we were left in 2004.
Yeah. So, and Jane created an award-winning series called Life Reimagined Today, and that was with AARP. So we're somewhat caught up. Okay, so what we're here to talk about... What we're here to talk about today is Jane Pauley's new book called Your Life Calling, Reimagining the Rest of Your Life. And it is fantastic. I read the whole thing, and we're going to talk about some of the amazing people, amazing in a different kind of way, but amazing people that Jane introduces us to in the book, and even more about yourself and your own reimagination and reinvention.
But well, we all could tell fascinating stories. I just happen to be the one with Naomi with a microphone on that everyone can hear now. So
let's hope. Okay, so at the start of the book, you say every baby boomer will have reached the age of 50 this year.
We're all in now. Not this year, at the end of January.
At the end of January.
We're all in, and on February 1st, the Gen Xers started turning 50. Welcome aboard.
And somebody else can write that book, right?
Yeah. No, they talk to me. You know, I have, I've heard it in these words multiple times from people in their 40s, if not even in their 30s. This is all we talk about. I have heard that. So, you know, the fact that I happen to be a boomer, I'm 63, a leading edge baby boomer. Not all baby boomers, not all of us identify with our we-ness. I was thinking about that the other day when Michelle Obama celebrated her 50th birthday, making her in the baby boom demographic,
barely,
and realized
barely, right?
She was 2 weeks old when the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan. So we have had very divergent experiences, and yet I think as a generation we probably are unique in either having our generation projected upon us or embraced. Mm-hmm. But I learned this the other day. It's not in the book, there are like 25 or more million more millennials than boomers.
Wow.
Because we did go out and multiply.
The baby boomers, boomers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So midlife, we're talking about and reinventing it. And I guess we'll just start with a really basic question, which is, you know, what is it about baby boomers and their midlives that made you want to write the book and that's so different than people who came before us?
Well, it is different. It's not so much different than what came before us. It's that we are the first to get a heads up about it. Mm. People have been living longer lives for a generation or two. And we will be like our parents or grandparents. You all know people who have lived to robust 90s or even people in triple digits. This is becoming more the norm than the exception. And yet we haven't thought about ourselves as having a future that could go on decades longer than what we think of as our conventional working lives, which could be a reality for many, many of us. So now that we do things together, we have come to an age, especially people like me, I'm 63, my husband is already 65, we look at the signs behind you, the exit. That's what retirement used to be like, an exit sign. Now, it is more like, and I think you'll identify with this, we still talk about retiring. We look forward to retiring. Maybe we don't look forward to retiring. Maybe we got retired. Well, whatever. Retirement now is more like a door that swings on a hinge, moving someone from one thing to something else. So that I often hear people talk about, I can't wait to retire so that I can. And they're not saying play golf. Mm-hmm. It's so that I can do something different. That is becoming the norm. Though we still use the word retirement, our vocabulary hasn't caught up with reality that things still happen. People still get sick. But we are more likely, as Gid Poole, one of the characters in my book, put it, to get do-overs. Something goes wrong, you fix it.
Right.
You get the new knee. You know, I was talking about my husband's cataracts. The doctor says he's not ready for surgery, which I think is fine because my husband doesn't know what I look like. Really. So we'll put that off as long as possible. This isn't about, I'm not in denial. I know life happens. I also know that there are people in their 50s and 60s still raising children or who have had children who have returned, mm-hmm. or are looking after aging parents and are listening to this conversation thinking, I don't have 5 minutes in a day to think about myself, so, you know, good for you, Jane. Well, we're coming to this at different stages in life. We aren't all simultaneously arriving at this hinge moment. So just a heads up, if you were to live another decade or two or three healthy years, what would you do? What will you do? That's the question.
And some people are frightened of the prospect of stopping their job that they've been doing for decades.
Well, a lot of people don't. This is typical of most people. Neuroscientists have asked test subjects to think about themselves in the future. And their brain scans light up in exactly the same pattern as when they're asked to think about a stranger. So we don't really think about ourselves in the future. There's something of a present bias. We think things will always be the way they are. They won't. But that doesn't mean that the person you are can't start anticipating what the stranger that is you in the future might like to do with your life. Is a plural, because you're sharing it with a stranger. That was why I put the plural.
And, you know, the breadth of how people, the people in your book, how they sort of get from this place to that place is incredible, because you might think, well, this is about people who fulfill a childhood dream, or this is about people who know from the time they're 17 what they're going to do. And I imagine you were as surprised as they were, or they were as surprised as you were, about the direction that their lives took in some cases.
On the top of my head, I don't think there's a single story here where someone was actively looking for their reinvention. One example may resonate with the way you feel about your own lives, was Thomas Betts. He's the alpaca
mm-hmm.
guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So Thomas Betts had a passion. You know, we're all supposed to follow our passion. Don't have one. But he did, and it was sailboat racing. Fixed up a sailboat, lived in Portland, Oregon, and he and his wife, Connie, had talked about maybe one day sailing
around
the
world.
But he had that sense of wanting something more. I often hear it, something missing, a sense of something different. And he wanted something different, but he didn't know what it was. He sold his business and was working part-time in sales for a marine supply company that sold his products. Customer comes in, asks for dock line, a lot of it. And Thomas says to him, well, you must have a lot of boats. And the guy says, oh, I don't have boats. These are for my alpacas.
Right.
And Thomas had this moment where he thought, this could be it. And he went home and he went home and he asked his wife, Connie, what's an alpaca? But sure enough, I mean, this isn't a book about just do it. He didn't just do it. They did their homework. Connie grew up on a farm. She'd been a high school biology teacher and had actually taught animal husbandry, which I only found out as we were wrapping up our gear and pulling out of the driveway. But he did his research. The guy that bought the dock line that had the alpacas let him manage the ranch for a while to see if he liked it and was any good at it. And he did, and he is. And do you know how he purchased his first small herd of alpacas, which are not inexpensive? He sold his sailboat. So, follow your passion, unless you discover you've got another passion that you hadn't thought about until it crossed your path. So, and people may have more than one passion, or they may have none. Then what are you going to do if you're following your passion?
So what about the sandcastle guy?
Oh.
This is just kind
yes.
of amazing.
Now, we live, I've been in Columbus, Ohio. I've been in St. Louis. I've been in Dallas. These are landlocked places. So telling a story about a guy who found his reimagined life on a beach didn't resonate. So, but in this audience, I mean, you could be half a dozen future sand carvers when I finish telling this story. Kirk Rademacher was a project manager at a cabinet-making firm in Oakland, California. It was a good job. When the phone rang, the person at the other end was rarely happy. The cabinets fit perfectly. No, it was usually, where are they? Something was wrong. It was a dark time in his life. He was going through a divorce. Probably was suffering a low-grade depression. One weekend, on a whim, goes to the beach, and he starts building a sand castle. And he described it to me as like the sun rising on all the horizons at once. Building this sand castle, people stopped to watch and engaged him in conversation. It was pulling him out of his isolation. He was talking to people. He was working with his hands. He was being creative. He had a degree in fine arts from college, being creative. He found himself going back every week, every weekend, to build something on the beach. He said, I knew somehow that beach was going to change my life. Well, in the course of his weekend experience at the beach, he discovered a community of sand carvers. Most of them were in their 20s. Sand carving is a profession, but About 5 years ago, it wasn't. So it wasn't as if he had missed it. It didn't exist. And he became, it turns out, he has a genuine talent. His degree in fine arts, he makes these fanciful pencil sketches, which have become the models for many of the three-dimensional carvings that he does around the world. One day, one of his young friends from the beach community called him with enthusiastically, said, called from Italy. They had been invited to go to Italy for an event. And he said, I can't go. I've got five projects lined up here. I don't have time coming to me. I can't go. He'd never been to Europe. He'd always wanted to go. He hung up the phone and he made a vow. In 6 months, I'll wrap it up. And he has become a professional sand carver. I saw him in Los Angeles, or in San Francisco recently. He was between travels. He makes, the first year, he probably made two-thirds of his cabinet-making salary, and now he makes more than twice as much. Yeah. I tell you the story not because any of you are going to quit your jobs and become sand carvers. I asked Kirk if he had advice, and he grudgingly gave me the advice I wanted him to share with you. And what he said was, if you are dissatisfied, don't just quit your job. Go find something you love. Maybe it's cooking, maybe it's drawing, maybe it's music. He said, maybe it's conversation. Whatever it is, just get more of that into your life. Your life will have more balance. So the Kirk Rademacher story isn't really about how he found a different career. It's how he put all, as he said, it's a confluence of everything he'd ever done in his life. His fine arts degree, the drafting tools from his drafting table are now a, you know, spade or a shovel on the beach. His pencil is, you know, anyway, he's using all of the experience and skills as a carpenter, and now he's working in sand.
And you talked about somebody else, I think it was an author you mentioned, who said, don't change more than one-eighth of your life at any time,
well,
right?
You know, maybe you've heard of Roger Rosenblatt. He's a best-selling author and a close friend. But he wrote a book years ago called 25 The Rules for Aging, hysterical. I'll find it on Google. But Roger's advice is, you know, if you're tempted to get a new job, just, you know, change your glasses or part your hair on the other side, you know. The message of the book really isn't go be somebody completely new. Because sometimes that feeling that many of you resonate to, I know you do, the idea that there could be something more, or it feels like something mm-hmm. missing. Mm-hmm. And we have the sense that everyone else has got it going and we're missing out on something. No, it's probably very nearby. And Naomi wanted to ask me about Gladys.
Yes, could you tell us about Gladys, please?
Thank you, I was hoping you'd ask. Actually, I told Naomi, ask me about Gladys. Gladys is not in the book, but she illustrates what I mean when I say oftentimes that something missing is you're the only one who's missing it, that we sometimes need to be told what our gifts are. In the book, I explain how my sister was once described this way. Ann Pauley is like an irreplaceable crystal in a priceless chandelier, which is lovely. What the hell did it mean? Okay. My sister was one of the first women to run a global high-tech manufacturing company. And this compliment was paid her in a corporate setting where you don't normally hear prose like that. But she said she knew what he meant, that her... She always felt her role on a leadership team was to help others shine. But that having that spoken out loud was validating and affirming. She said, I knew it was a skill I had, but I didn't know it was important or that anyone had noticed. But having it publicly affirmed gave her the confidence to deploy it with more widely in her work and outside of it. So having a gift identified is empowering. My sister told me that I had a gift for helping people see themselves in powerful and positive new ways. And like my sister, I'd never had that thought before, but I knew what she meant. Mm-hmm. It described the stories I thought I did best, the stories I liked doing most, which weren't always what NBC paid me to do. But your life calling is helping people see the future in powerful and positive new ways. So I'm on a book tour, and I'm in St. Louis. It's a frigid Saturday night. Before the event, there was a reception, and when I walked in, the first people I noticed, a group of three women sitting together, elderly women. One of them was in a wheelchair. She reminded me of my mother, who had been an invalid the last 15 years of her life. So I stopped to say hello to these three women. And we chatted briefly, and then I made my way into the room. Pretty soon, Gladys comes striding over with her cane, and she strode over with that cane. Tiny little woman with bright, shining eyes. People on book tour either that want to tell me a story or ask me a question. With Gladys, it was both. The story she wanted to tell me was that she had redecorated her room. I assumed assisted living because she was 96. And she had decided, she told me, to go modern, not classical. Her question, how would someone over 90 reinvent themselves? And I totally punted the question, and I said, well, Gladys, I think you probably are the expert on that. If you don't know the answer, why don't you spend tomorrow thinking about it? Because I'm sure there is an answer. I kept thinking about Gladys, particularly when I saw she was sitting in the front row with the two other women. She stayed with me, this amazing 96-year-old woman. And a couple of days later, I thought, Gladys has the gift for living. And more importantly, the gift for sharing her gift for living. And I wondered, how often does that woman in the wheelchair, or the other woman with them, all of them over 90, how often does Gladys get her to dress up and go out on a wintry January night in St. Louis to hear an author lecture? I'll bet Gladys does that all the time. So, would that I could go back and tell Gladys, you have a gift for living and a gift for sharing that gift. She might say to me, well, tell me something I don't know. Or she might say, you're right. And on recognizing that, that's her reimagined life, to wake up in the morning and know, how will I share my gift for living today? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not an extreme makeover. You know, for many of us, it's just a matter of answering the question in a new way or asking the question in a different way.
And it's so interesting how some of the people get there. I mean, to me, that was really the takeaway for me, was there's no one path.
There absolutely is not a repeated story in there.
Exactly. And I'm particularly interested, or I'd particularly like for the audience to hear about some of the people who went on and really changed the world. They didn't just find a good thing to do that made them happy. They really changed the world as a result.
I'll tell two stories, but I do with a caveat. Mm-hmm. I'm from the Midwest. This is real. I'm not trying to astonish you with the amazing stories that would be paralyzing, frankly, not inspiring. I mean, they make good stories, but you know, sometimes if an epic, you know, reinvention story, you know, well, I could never do that. I'm not going there. Okay, so I will tell you this story. Jenny Bowen, as I interviewed her at her home in Berkeley, California, she's a filmmaker, would have fit in here. I mean, she and her husband, they could live in Brantford or Guilford. They could be your neighbors. I couldn't figure out. I like to connect the dots, and I just couldn't see how this seemingly ordinary woman had, one day looking out her kitchen window, had an epiphany that would go on to become a foundation which is at work in every province of China, changing the Chinese orphanage systems that we all remember early in the 90s when we first learned about the one-child policy and the abandoned girls as people tried for a boy, and tens, hundreds of thousands of abandoned baby girls, and many American families blessed by adopting these baby girls as a result, including Jenny and her husband Richard, mm-hmm. who read the story in the New York Times one day. They had started their family early. They'd been parents. Their children were grown and gone. But they read this story, and Richard says, we should do something. Maybe we could bring one home. So they begin an adoption process. It took a couple of years. They finally go to China. They meet their daughter, Maya. She has no language because no one ever spoke to her. She was almost two and couldn't walk. She had no personality, a blank affect.
And you talked about the whole orphanage where no babies
she
were
said,
crying.
She
right?
said to visit one of these orphanages is to see hundreds of cribs in a single room with two, sometimes three babies in a crib, with untrained and overworked caregivers. All the best they could do was to feed and change. Mm-hmm. It was heartbreaking.
And none of the babies crying.
And silence.
Yeah.
A room with hundreds of babies, silence. So they bring their baby home, and she's editing a film, brings the edit room into her home, and has baby Maya on her lap for 6 months. Mm-hmm. Maya's first words, first spoken words, "he didn't do it," were lines of dialogue from the movie that she was editing. And everybody laughed, but Jenny thought, there's a person in there, and she's working. 6 months later, it's summer. They're having a 4th of July party in the backyard. Maya is romping in the backyard, singing, playing with her friends, and Jenny has her epiphany. I know how to fix it. All it took was the love of family. I could bring the love of family to the children who will never be adopted and will never have family. What she did was she persuaded the Chinese government, not famously open to foreign ideas, to let her do a pilot program, which, as I have already explained, has grown a thousandfold, to train nannies to bond with children. And very quickly, they became children. They acted like children. And the Chinese officials were impressed and allowed an American NGO to do this. Now, she was like you. But how did she do this? She explained to me that everything she needed, because she didn't know any more about child development than any mother does or any father, nothing about foreign policy, starting a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. But as a filmmaker, she said, my job was to imagine a world that doesn't exist and make it happen. She was really good at research, even before Google. Logistics, casting. Making a movie is a complicated enterprise. You need a team. Who are the best people? She set about finding the best people. And the other parents of adopted Chinese daughters have been among her most ardent financial supporters. That's how she did it. The same, it's the Kirk Rademacher story all over again. Or as another woman, Barbara Allen, put it, she said of her amazing life, reinvented, she'd been a stay-at-home mother 20 years and started a nonprofit in Philadelphia, I'll let you read about, but she said, it was like weaving all the threads of my life and experience into a new tapestry. She also was an art major. But this is true of all of us. You know, maybe we have a job, maybe we have a career. We've maybe raised children or looked after people or volunteered or had hobbies or whatever we've done. The variety of things that we've done, combined with my political science major, combine in unique ways to, in an entirely different context, enable you to be the person you are, but be doing something mm-hmm. you haven't thought of yet.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your Aunt Martha. Your Aunt Martha, who says, what's all this talk about reinvention?
Okay, my aunt lived to be a robust 92 and then lived two more years, which is the pattern of the experts, of which I am not one, tell me will likely be the case. A long period of midlife, defined as no longer young but not yet old, followed inevitably by the decline of old age, but will come later in life, as it did with my aunt. Around the age of 92, she did begin to decline. And she was a no-nonsense woman. What's all this fuss about reinvention? That's how she would say it. My aunt was widowed at the age of 50 and had a child late in life. So at 50, she had a teenage son to raise. And when I was growing up in the 50s, my Aunt Martha was literally the only working mother I knew. But she had a series of jobs. I mean, reinvention was just how Aunt Martha rolled.
Wasn't a word she used for it.
She started retail clothing at the mall. She sold real estate, got a license. She wanted more stability. She got a job at a savings and loan. She became the manager. One day she was robbed, and I was a reporter in Indianapolis, and I heard the call on the radio of the West Lane branch of the. And I called her. I said, "Were you robbed?" And she said, "Yes, and it's not funny." She was very funny. But so Aunt Martha is 65, and she's given her mandatory retirement papers. She stuffs them in her purse and walks across the street, literally, to a travel agency. She wasn't planning a trip. She got a job leading tours. My brother-in-law called them the bus people. There were some trips to Hawaii, a couple to Europe, but mostly Knoxville, Tennessee, you know, the Smoky Mountains, that sort of thing. And she just loved it. She was an entertainer. Everyone called her Aunt Martha. She finally retired at the age of 75 when the travel agency closed, and she still had 20 more years to go. That's what we can expect, to be 75 and to have, in her case, 18 more robust years. My sister and I laugh at once. She was a serial volunteer, which I think is one of the aspects or attributes that seem to make it easier for some people. But Aunt Martha always volunteered. And she was talking about the volunteering at the old folks' home and how she was kind of bragging about how she'd gotten all the old folks to sing their high school songs. And we're thinking Aunt Martha was probably older than most of the old folks. But, you know, this idea of adapting to whatever came her way. And she had a lot of tragedy in her life, was blessed with good mental health, mm-hmm. Robust physical health. Not all of us are. Mm-hmm. But she is, she's a role model for me, primarily because of a quality that I could imagine myself having, my Aunt Martha's sense of dailiness. She started every day with intentionality. Mm-hmm. She got out of bed, she changed her clothes, she got dressed. She always looked like she was going somewhere. She had a sensible breakfast. She'd had read her meditation. She called her friend. These mutual elderly people call, you know, you still awake? You there? And then, you know, so beginning, and then she did her crossword puzzle, and she just led a life of intentionality. I could lead a life of inertia. I could very easily fall into my comfort zone, which is a particular spot on a sofa in my living room. It doesn't, reinvention doesn't come naturally to me like it did to my Aunt Martha. But I recognize that at 63, what will I be doing when I'm 73 or 83? I haven't a clue. I haven't a clue, by the way, and I'm not saying that at the age of 63 I'd better figure it out. Just saying that I want to be the kind of person who adapts to opportunity or contingency. They'll come and go. And my goal in life is really pretty simple, is to be someone who tries, which for me will take a little effort because of the inertia thing.
I have a million more questions, but so do you, I'm sure. So I would love to open it up now to your questions, if that's okay with you, Mrs. Pauly.
Yeah, oh, me? Yes.
Is that okay with you? Okay.
Yes, that's very fine.
Ms. Pauly.
Yes.
So please walk up to one of the, are there two microphones?
Yep.
Larry? Larry's the microphone guy. So please walk up to a microphone and ask away. And if you don't, I will continue with my questions.
Before we begin, I just wanted to quickly announce that there's a car double parked outside. Is that terrible? Just so you don't get towed or anything like that. There's a blue BMW 766YLG, just so if you, if that's your car, you may want to go and move it.
Okay.
Anyone please come down?
But don't jump up right away. We'll all know who you are.
Yeah.
We'll hide you. Yeah.
Yes.
I love the interview so far, and Ashley Jane, my name is Tom. I had the pleasure of working with you back in 1987 in China.
Tom.
Martin.
How are you?
Well,
do you
remember
know,
me. Yeah.
Did I tell you, my youngest son, who's in the book, is Tom.
There
aren't that many Toms. Yeah.
So,
anyway.
No, my question was, because, you know, I spent about 20 years in the television industry before I reinvented myself to some degree, and I was just wondering if, you know, I don't know, it seems that it can be kind of an abrupt industry, unexpected changes and pressures and all of that. If that helped prepare you for, you know, the changes you're talking about that we all face at some point.
Well, you enable me to tell another story. I don't know if you remember Ann Colbell or Ann Schlitt before she became Ann Colbell, who was my oldest associate and best friend. Ann is still there.
Wow.
She's still at NBC. And I tell you that story, Anne's story, because Anne isn't as enthralled with reinvention and reimagining. Change is not her favorite word. Stay same, fine with Anne. Anne is always talking about getting her ducks in a row. My sister once asked her, well, isn't the point to get your ducks in the water? So Anne has suffered most of her adult life, which we have spent together, with advice from me on change. I'm a change agent. Life is as most dynamic for me when it's in transition. But Anne is, she's nostalgic and does not embrace change. She goes about her life in a more methodical way. If she needs to change, she does her research, she does her homework, she talks to people who have been there, she dithers, she frets, she asks, you know, the word is not coming. Happens all the time now. Only a problem if you have a career in broadcasting. But I realize that Anne is doing it her way, at her pace. And just because we used to talk about news cycles and how the news cycle's speeding up. Well, now there isn't even a news cycle. That's how fast it's going. If Anne chooses to live her life at the cycle that she is meant to live, then go to it. And I congratulate her for her reinvented life. But Anne, here's the point I'm getting to, because it's a very important point that you raise. Anne told me recently, I will never embrace change the way you do, but I am beginning to accept it. Anne has been at NBC for 35 years. In the last 15, a lot of change has happened. Downsizing, buyouts, there have been several rounds of buyouts that Anne has not taken and taken the consequences, and she's valued, so she's still there. But there is research that shows that it's a little counterintuitive, but it explains why our New Year's resolutions fail so often. We think that we have to be ready for change to happen, when the opposite is the case. The brain sees change happen, and that's what makes the brain ready for change. So whether it's, you know, you want to start a fitness program or you want to stop smoking. Don't wait to be ready. The brain seeing a non-smoker, you've become one. The brain seeing you active and whatever you're doing, you are more fit. In Anne's case, I think seeing all of the change happening around her helped prepare her brain for making change. Long answer to your question.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you. So can I ask a second question?
I don't see anybody else lined up behind you.
No, I was just curious. I'm eager to read your book. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I was not working for the Today Show, I worked for Charles Corral, where many of our interviewees were 100 years old and whatnot. So I love what you're talking about. But I was just wondering if you noticed cultural differences, because I know you interviewed a lot of people all around the world, not just here in the U.S., mm-hmm. in terms of reinvention, mm-hmm. and just like taking it in stride.
Well, I suspect that the concept is going to be, it's kind of quintessentially American to believe in the future, even if you're not planning for it. But here's something that is universal that I read in the same paper that you probably read. Researchers were surprised to discover that feelings of well-being plummet in the decade of the 40s. Dissatisfaction, bottoms out. But around the age of 50, and this surprised them, feelings of well-being and satisfaction begin to rise again. And they keep on rising. And they keep on rising. And that this is true among rich and poor, men and women, and around the world. So I got that. Thank you, Tom. Nice to see you again.
Hi, Jane. I'm Sherry. So going back to what you were talking about, the change, so I'm kind of in the situation where I've always been accustomed to change. I've always adapted to change, and I embrace it. Now I've actually gone through a change, but I'm still struggling. When I was younger, it was easy for me to pick up whatever change I wanted to do and go forward with it. Now that we're older, you know, what advice do you have to help? It's more of a struggle now to figure out what change do I want to do next. So do you have any advice to help people?
You know, my book is not a how-to book, because I don't have the good advice except to assure you that we're in this together, and that if there is a core message in my book, I found it in a headline in the Washington Post. It was I don't know what the story was about. I just got the headline. And the headline was, inspiration is everywhere, but you have to be looking. There's something about having your antenna up, and I think that explains the Thomas Betts alpaca story, that he had been primed. He and his wife had talked about what they would be doing. No answer, but he really was primed to find it, even though he didn't know what it was. When it crossed his field of vision, because his antenna was up and he was primed, He recognized it, and he seized the opportunity. So, you know, you can't force your epiphanies, but you can have confidence that as long as you're looking, you're going to be a lot more likely to find it than if you do what I did 10 years ago. I wrote a memoir, and I'm not nostalgic. I wasn't taking notes. I remember, I've got the memory of an Etch-a-Sketch. So for me to write a memoir was kind of comical. But my purpose in writing Skywriting was, I thought, looking back, like connecting the dots, I guess, would help illuminate a path toward the future, because I'm very future-oriented. I think the book was fine, but the big soul search is not necessary. The expert in the book that I quote more than another is a professor at Harvard whose research is in career transitions. And I extrapolate some of her research into midlife transitions. And she said, people make the mistake of thinking they have to know the destination before they set out on the journey. And this is the most important thing. Do is more important than think. We've got to think our way out of problems. We're all head people, all of us. We're 90% up here, and we think our head's got to figure things out. We spend so much time thinking, when do is how you get out into the world and become exposed to that alpaca moment, if you will, when you recognize or introduce to someone you'd never met before an opportunity you'd not thought of before. And the brain learns most from failure. Trial and error. Do is more important than think. And the brain learns from seeing change happen. That's pretty much all I got.
These aren't stories of people who had an easy time of it by any means, you know?
No, most of them aren't baby boomers, actually, because to tell stories of people who have been there and done it, I had to find people who were older and did it already. Yes.
Hi. My name is Bill. Did you say you did not have a passion in life?
I did say that.
I do.
What's yours?
Movies.
Movies?
Love movies, film, reviewing them, talking about them. My senior thesis in college was on Paul Newman. I wanted to get in the film industry. I became a prosecutor.
Makes sense.
Now I've retired as a prosecutor, and I'm involved with film and doing things and talking to people, not in a professional way, in a fun way.
God bless. You know what? You remind me of a conversation that it's in the book, but I heard it repeated last night at a party. You may relate to this, I suspect. I was driving up here. Gary and I were on 95 and heading north, and I was making notes for the book. It was last year I was writing the book. And I brought something up, and Gary says to me, you know, I think I've lost the capacity for boredom. Now, I knew my husband had a rich daydream life. He sometimes imagines himself the president of the United States. He says, as he's driving the car, I'm also in a rock band. And then, hear that song, car songs on the radio, says, I'm playing bass. Gary was talking last night to another man at an event we went to who had that in common. Neither one of them remember the last time they were bored. Gary doesn't need my book. They look at me, you know, do you ever bored? And I said, where's my cell phone? I mean, there's research. The more often you check your email or, you know, that's boredom that sends us. Yes, I am familiar with boredom. I suspect you aren't.
No, I'm not.
Yeah.
Some people have to work and never retire.
Yeah.
I was afraid to retire. I did, and now I have too much going on.
Yeah. Well, I hope there are a lot of you, but my husband is one, too. We were at a party for the author Ron Chernow, the biographer, and Ron can't remember being bored. He says, I'm one of those people, there just isn't enough time in a day for all the things.
Well, I feel the same way, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
How are we doing, Gideon?
Oh, please. Hi. I'm Georgianne, and I'm interested in if you've had any observations about women at midlife responding to challenges and issues that maybe come up as they think about reinventing themselves compared to men. Do you see anything between
gender
women
differences?
And men?
Well, first of all, you know, with women, you know, change is part of our biology, and I, you know, so we got that going. That said, I saw a post in a More magazine website. It was a woman began by asking, "Does anyone have any ideas for a simple business?" And then she wanted to explain her sons. She'd been a stay-at-home mom, off to college, and very quickly get to the heart of the problem. Can anyone tell me who I am? So, you know, she was absolutely stuck. I wanted to jump through the internet and tell her, you know, lady, you knew that asking, so the internet would come up with an answer for you. You had confidence that there was an answer to your question, who you are. And I thought, a year later, I wish I could find out how she answered her question. But I think it might be easier for women. The gender question, Tom Brokaw asked me that question at the 92nd Street Y a week or two ago. And I said that I had realized that of the, I've done 37 interviews, they're not all the stories are in the book, but I can think of 5 or 6 men who have cried. I've seen women cry if, you know, a memory, a loss, a regret. But it's the men who cry because they have found something so precious, like Kirk Rademacher, as he told me about discovering sand carving when the other sand carvers were in their 20s and he found it so late in life. And Pauly G, who's the pizza guy, if you read the story, he's, you know, found this thing. He'd been an accountant before he opened Pauly G's restaurant in, forever in Brooklyn, Greenpoint. Go there. So 5 or 6 of these men who have cried tears of regret that they found something precious so late in life. Pauly G was in the audience at the 92nd Street Y. And at the end of the evening, he gave me a handwritten note. And it said, Jane, didn't you know those were tears of joy? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. How about one more question? We got some book signing to do.
Yeah, it's up to you.
No, yeah, one more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second time I said hello to you at the deli counter at Stop and Shop and you ignored me.
Really?
I think we pump gas together at the mobile across the street.
Right.
I think for every inspirational story, you know, I'm 60 and I have lots of friends who, you know, want to reinvent themselves. But you have to know that we teach a lifespan course here. Some of our students are here to come and see you because we cover, you know, all the generations. But, you know, I think this is the first generation, these kids in my class, who are not going to do better than their parents. It's the first time. You know,
Too early to say, but I know what you mean.
And, you know, we've been helicopter parents, a lot of us. We try to organize our kids' times and hopefully push them along, and we find out that they still need us at age 30 and 35. And then we're sandwiched in between our parents growing so much older. It's almost like we're parents, again, to two separate generations. Do you find in your travels and whatnot, these people who want to reinvent themselves and are now stifled because they're sandwiched in between taking these two groups?
I've heard it described as the club sandwich.
Really?
Yeah, so many. I mean, to have so many responsibilities simultaneously, as I, you know, said earlier, that, yeah, I absolutely recognize that a lot of us don't have 5 minutes to think about, you know, ourselves, but will. One day, will.
Yeah.
You're at 60, you're a kid. You're a kid.
Oh, I have no problem. I've told my kids they're on their own.
But the kids,
my mother too.
it's
not about me, and it's the people.
So my Tom, there's an email, and I talk about getting finding a message in my inbox, and it's from my son Tom, who is my youngest. Tommy was probably 22 or 23, maybe, when he sent me this message. The Jane Pauley show was over. My daytime one season, mm-hmm. failure.
Yeah.
Felt good about that. Tried, failed, rebounded. That's fine. But people started asking, what are you doing with yourself? And then it became how you enjoy in retirement. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting on that place in the sofa. The fact is, I had my laptop open, and I really was working the problem. I really was. But Tom was concerned. Email says, Dear Mom, I think you've surveyed the field long enough. Thinking about what you might want to do, what you might be good at, what your options are. Nobody in this family doubts your talent, but I don't want to see you squandering, you know, your talents. He sums up, it's time to make your move.
Wow.
Love, Tom.
23.
I think he was 23. I think Tom's, the millennials, the 100 million of them, I've read will have 8 jobs before they're 30. What they have in common with us is that in their tunnel vision, they think everyone else has got it going but them. You know, everyone else has got careers started. Everyone else, they're going to weddings every weekend. You know, now the babies are coming, and then, you know, and they feel like they're the only one who hasn't figured it out. Mm-hmm. Not knowing that the ones that have the careers going when they're 32 are going to say, you know, shoot me, why did I become, I think the 20-somethings are simply going to roll through life, cycle through life, through changes as opportunity and contingency arrive, we'll deal with it. And I believe that our generation, the boomers, our legacy, mm-hmm. we will redeem our youthful promise and actually leave a positive legacy to the degree that we model for the Gen Xers and the Gen Ys and the millennials and every generation that comes after us to see that midlife, mid-midlife, is the time when you get to put it all together. And whether it's have fun, whether it's seek adventure, whether it's help others, whether it's start a business and make some money, whatever it is, we are modeling an aspirational time of life that begins around the age of 50 and then just keeps on getting better.
Yeah. At least they won't have to fixate on their pension because there are none, so.
No. No.
Wanted to end on that note.
Yeah, that's a great note. Thanks.
Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you, Jane Pauley.